From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. I'm Doug Bernard, sitting in this week for Carol Castiel. Our guest on this edition of the program, author and technologist Kentaro Toyama, author of the just-published book Geek Heresy, Rescuing Social Change from the Cult of Technology. A little more than a decade ago, Kentaro Toyama was a successful engineer and computer technologist working at Microsoft. But he wanted something more. He wanted to put technology to use in helping people climb out of poverty. He traveled to India, where he spent the next 5 years supervising over 50 projects in some of that nation's poorest villages. What he learned was not what he expected, and he's now compiled his experiences and lessons in the book Geek Heresy. Kentaro Toyama joins us from our VOA studio in New York City. Welcome to the program. Kentaro Toyama, your book is titled Geek Heresy. What is heretical about what's in this book?
So you can think of a geek as somebody who makes a fetish of technological solutions. And the heresy is that technology has limits in the kind of problems that it can solve. Specifically, it's not a solution to very deep social challenges.
Well, I suppose that could be said about many things, but technology does have a part to play and a role to play in making the world a better place, no?
Absolutely. So the way I put it is that technology amplifies underlying human forces. So where those human forces are positive and capable, technology can certainly augment that. But it also means that technology doesn't help much in cases where the human institutions are either dysfunctional or corrupt.
Why was it important for you to write this book?
I felt compelled to write this book because I'm a computer scientist by training, and I spent several years in India trying to use technology to alleviate poverty, to do projects in agriculture, education, healthcare, governance, microfinance, and so on. And at the end of it, I looked back, and what I realized was even with terrific technology, ultimately, what caused the technology to have good impact were the partners that we worked with. It was the human beings, and it was what they were capable of doing that made the difference.
So less the machine and more the man.
That's right.
We'll get into those experiences that you had in India in just a moment. But I'm curious a little bit about your background. You're a computer scientist by training. You worked at Microsoft. You must have some affection and affinity for technology, I would think.
Absolutely. I mean, I grew up thinking that I would always become a scientist or an engineer. You know, I grew up with the biographies of Thomas Edison and Isaac Newton, Albert Einstein, all thinking that it was science and technology that made the world a better place.
Right. And do you think that that allure is shared by many people in your field these days?
Oh, absolutely. You know, it's amazing the degree to which we have so much in common in terms of our kind of collective background of, you know, what kind of biographies we read growing up, you know, who we idolized as children.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's definitely true that in Silicon Valley, there's a strong sense that it really is technology that makes the world a better place.
Right. Let's go back to your travels to India. You had been, as I understand, you'd been a Microsoft executive and researcher. You'd had a very successful career. What was it that lured you to go to India in 2004?
So before then, I was doing research in an area called computer vision, which is a kind of offshoot of artificial intelligence in which we try to automate computers' understanding of imagery and video. But after 7 years of that, I just felt that, you know, it was one thing to develop interesting technologies for people who could afford it, but I really wanted to have a different kind of social impact. So India seemed to me to be a perfect place to do that.
And what about India? Why the draw to that place?
India is interesting because on the one hand, around that time, it was becoming known as an IT superpower. So, you know, technologically, they're certainly advanced in many incredible ways.
Sure.
But in a country that's, you know, close to 1.2, 1.3 billion people, two-thirds of the country is still incredibly poor by any American standard.
I think you first arrived in Bangalore, is that right?
That's right.
What did you find there?
In Bangalore, it was interesting, just the sheer contrast. So, you know, you could find these technology centers where they had these amazing buildings, which, you know, frankly looked shinier and fancier than any corporate building in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And literally right outside their walls would be the, you know, the most extreme poverty that, you know, I had at least personally seen.
Yeah.
In terms of, you know, farming villages where people lived on a dollar a day, often kind of tent housing where, you know, people migrating into the city lived on, again, very shabby conditions.
My reading of this book suggests that you went into these projects and you went to India really more as a technologist than as a social worker. Was that intimidating in any way to really be starting something so completely new and different?
Absolutely. I mean, it certainly takes a lot of just kind of cultural adjustment to get used to not only differences in language, culture, geography, but also, you know, completely different economic circumstances. In my case, I was very conscious that this wasn't something that I could do on my own. And so we generally tended to work with nonprofit partners, organizations that had good rapport with the communities that we wanted to work with.
How long were you in India and how many projects did you contribute to or oversee?
I was in India for a little over 5 years, and over that time, I was involved in some way or another with probably over 50 different research projects where the goal was to use digital technology in some way to support socioeconomic growth.
You address a number of those in the book and, you know, sort of experiences and lessons learned. And I will also just point out that the book itself is a good read, but you have an extensive notes section. In some ways, this almost read more like a dissertation in some ways than a book. Was that intentional?
That's probably says more about the evolution of me as a writer. I'm trained as an academic and as a researcher, so my tendency, of course, is to support everything I write with citations to existing literature and to things that you can point to as fact. But, of course, you know, I understand that the average reader is not interested in all the citations, so the endnotes are really kind of, you know, what's left over of my thinking process.
Right. Give us a sense as to maybe some of the first earliest projects that you began working on.
So, for example, we did a lot of projects in education. We found that, you know, a surprising number of public schools in India, they're actually called government schools. Public schools there are actually private schools, strangely. But government
sort of like
schools,
the English system, I guess.
That's right, exactly. The government schools in India, you know, amazing number of them actually have computer labs, but they can't afford that many computers, so they tend to have like 4 or 5 computers in a single room. And, of course, classrooms full of, let's say, 30 or 40 children would come in. And at each PC, you know, 10 kids would basically crowd around. One dominant child would take over the mouse and keyboard, and everybody else would not be able to interact.
Mm-hmm.
So in a project that we called Multipoint, we basically allowed each PC to have multiple mice, and then each mouse would have a corresponding cursor on screen.
Which I have to say strikes me as a sort of a brilliant insight. I'd never had thought previously of having multiple users of one computer. Was this just an idea that was sort of born in the moment?
Yeah, it was born out of this experience where we thought, okay, well, here is a situation where it looks like a technological solution would be the perfect thing.
Right. So is that an example where a new bit of technology actually has a positive impact?
Interestingly, it does exactly in places where education is already going well. In other words, where the, you know, headmaster is willing to provide some resources for IT and where the teachers know what to do with the technology, it can actually help. But what we found as we tried to roll the project out in other schools, exactly in those schools that most needed help, you know, where the teachers were perhaps not as confident over their technical skills or where they didn't have control of the classroom, this technology actually made things worse.
Give us a real-world example, something that you saw in your time there where introducing technology not only didn't really help, but actually may have made things worse.
So in another education project, I remember going to watch the teacher try to run a class in which he was using one of our pieces of software to show images on a projector. And, you know, he initially couldn't get the projector to work, so he started fumbling around with the equipment. And after a few minutes, I thought I should jump in and help because, you know, the class time was being wasted. We ended up having to plug the power into another electrical outlet and then reboot the computer. And so, you know, by the time we got everything up and running, it was, you know, halfway through a 45-minute class. We had effectively wasted 50% of the class time just trying to get the technology to work.
I assume that you went to India with that spirit of embracing technology. I mean, this is what you had done with your life, and this you thought to yourself, aha, this is a good way to actually make some kind of social contribution using things that I know.
That's exactly right.
Jazz America!
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and The Voice of America.
Our guest, Kentaro Toyama, author of the just-published book, Geek Heresy, Rescuing Social Change from the Cult of Technology. Obviously, in your time, you went through an evolution of your thinking, though. Was it while you were in India or once you left that you really began kind of exploring, you know, the basic fundamentals of how does technology work, when does it work positively, and when should perhaps we look at other solutions, perhaps more human solutions?
So very early on, I began to see that, you know, many of our projects, which even when they worked well in the lab or in experiments, kind of didn't work as well when we tried to roll them out. And so over the years, I kept trying to answer the question, you know, what's the pattern here? I'm a scientist by training, so I'm looking for patterns and, you know, causes. And what I ultimately arrived at is that the technology needs to be reasonably good to begin with, but however good the technology, what ultimately affects whether or not it's being put to good use is actually people. It's other organizations.
You know, I wonder to what degree the same could be said, you know, forgive me the example, but about money. For example, there are all kinds of foundations and government programs, USAID and the Rockefeller Foundation and the Gates Foundation, etc. Billions of dollars are spent to try and help improve people's lives. And any number of those activities really don't yield a good result or as much of a positive result as they would like. But I don't think you would then go back and say, well, you know, money isn't working.
Yeah, I think that's a keen insight. And in chapter 4 of my book, I actually talk about something called packaged interventions as a kind of generalized notion of technology. I think in all of these situations, it's not that the technology is bad. It's not that money is good or bad. Mm-hmm. It's that we are kind of assuming that something that a fundamental effect is to amplify human beings is itself causing a positive outcome.
Let's focus on that. I think it's very common to hear, certainly we've heard it here many times, people refer to either the internet or, you know, digital technologies, computers basically, as neither being good nor bad. They're sort of neither. But you actually say they're not good, they're not bad, they're not neither. But to use that word you just used, they amplify. Can you expand on that?
Absolutely. So amplification is really just another way of saying that the technology is a tool that augments human power. But what that means is that whether the technology is good or bad is entirely dependent on the social environment that it's placed in. So one of the really interesting things about the internet is that it's actually very different in every country. You know, we talk about the internet as one thing. And if you think of it as just a technology, it might make sense that the internet in the United States is the same as the internet in China, for example. Mm-hmm. But in fact, what happens on the internet is completely different. And it's more a reflection and an augmentation of the underlying politics of the country than it is something that inherently brings with it, let's say, democracy or openness.
You're listening to Press Conference USA on The Voice of America. I'm Doug Bernard, sitting in for Carol Castiel. And our guest this week is Kentaro Toyama, author of the just-published book Geek Heresy, published by Public Affairs. This quick reminder that you can download this or any episode of Press Conference USA via our iTunes podcast. It's free, and you can find it on the iTunes tab at our website, voanews.com/PCUSA. You can also connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel VOA, or send us an old-fashioned email to PCUSA@voanews.com. And here's a shout-out to loyal Facebook fan Rotkang Job from Kuru, Nigeria. Our guest on this edition of the program, author and technologist Kentaro Toyama, author of the just-published book Geek Heresy, Rescuing Social Change from the Cult of Technology. Well, to this point, you write in your book, quote, technology acts like a lens, magnifying and amplifying how governments act on their gravest concerns. So give us an example of that.
So in China, one of the things that everybody knows is that there's an incredible censorship machine. It's probably, you know, 300,000, 400,000 persons strong.
The so-called Great Firewall.
Part of it is the Great Firewall, but there's also, you know, there are actually human beings who read blog posts and decide to take them down or not based on what the government believes is suitable. And what's interesting about that is that because it's such a large effort, political scientists such as Gary King at Harvard can actually study this large phenomenon and get a better sense for what the Chinese government is actually after. And so what Professor King has discovered, for example, is that it's not that the Chinese government is afraid of criticism, because it seems that they actually allow quite a bit of it online. What they're actually afraid of is anything that might instigate public action. So they're afraid of protests. They're afraid of demonstrations. They're even afraid of kind of innocuous things that would bring people together, even in a political context.
So it's not dissent, apparently, that's so troubling to Chinese officials. It's the idea of collective non-government action?
That's right. And you could argue that that's exactly how Facebook was used, for example, in the Egyptian Revolution.
You know, a lot has been written about that. So, for example, you know, we talk about technology's positive and negative impacts. I think people always seem to be quick when there is foment in some country somewhere. You hear these labels. It's the Twitter revolution. It's the Facebook revolution. We really try to eschew that here because, in the end, it never really seems to pan out. You know, an early example, even before Egypt, was the so-called Green Revolution in Iran in the mid-2000s. Technology, social media was playing a key role at that point in organizing people. But in the end, not only did it not make a difference, but some people may actually have suffered because of their use of these technologies.
That's right. You know, I think we shouldn't be calling these things Facebook revolutions or Twitter revolutions any more than we should call the American Revolution a lantern revolution because of Paul Revere and one if by land, two if by sea.
Right.
You know, the reality is revolutionaries will use whatever communication tools at their disposal for the sake of the revolution. But the cause of revolution is obviously not the technology, not the communication channel. It's some kind of frustration leveled at the government.
You know, earlier on you said that the internet is not the same in every country. And I can confess you addressed a problem that you encountered in India, which I had just not thought of, which is that of people who are illiterate, people who can't read or write. And if you think about that, you know, what is the internet? What is a computer at that point, except mostly gibberish and a couple pictures?
Absolutely. You know, I think there's a tendency for everybody to call the internet whatever it is that they personally experience with the internet. So, you know, well-educated, reasonably wealthy people who have, you know, strong social ties in America, for example, think of the internet as something that allows free speech, allows them to connect with friends, allows them to amplify the knowledge work that they do. And of course, all of that is true for them. But you take the same technology and give it to somebody who is, again, illiterate, possibly is, you know, marginalized with respect to their political power, doesn't have a lot of strong social ties, it doesn't have the same value and the same benefit for them.
I'm not an educator, but I perceive, and I think the conventional wisdom is that on the whole, technology is better, that having technology in the classroom, for example, is better than having no technology, and it is overall has a positive impact on learning. You would disagree?
Yeah, I would disagree with that. And again, I go back to amplification. You know, technology amplifies whatever pedagogical capacities in the system itself. So certainly for good schools with, you know, strong budgets and teachers that are well-trained with technology, they can probably make use of technology in a positive way.
Mm-hmm.
But exactly in those schools where, you know, the students are struggling to learn even the basics, technology is likely to prove distraction more than anything else.
You know, I remember some decades ago, when cable broadcasting was really kind of taking off. It was a newish technology, and there was a lot of talk back in my home state of Michigan and elsewhere around this country about how this technology was going to, you know, have a major impact on education, sort of telelearning and that kind of thing. And the ideas always seemed intriguing, but in the end, it just seemed like, you know, a lot of these things didn't really pan out. Were you seeing essentially the same thing with the new computer technologies?
I think that is exactly the right analogy. In fact, you can go back to the 50s and 60s when people thought that regular television was going to completely replace school-based education because now we had not only audio but imagery piped right into everybody's living rooms.
I mean, television does have use as an educational tool, but generally I think most people would perceive it as an entertainment tool. Do you see a similar situation? Is it an analogous, do you think, with computers and the internet?
I think that is exactly the right analogy. In other words, yes, television can be used as an educational tool, and in the hands of a good teacher, it probably will be. But it's the teacher that decides whether or not the television will be used in a positive way or whether it will just be used for kind of empty entertainment. And the same is true of the internet.
These 50-some projects that you went through, and again, you detail and document, there really seemed to be a process where you were really trying to kind of figure out, you know, did this work, did this not work, what went wrong, what went right, that sort of thing. Beyond this human element, were there other elements or essentials that you found for finding success in deploying technology in a useful, positive way?
That's an interesting way of asking the question. I mean, I would say it all comes down to human elements. But of course, there's a gazillion ways in which the human element makes a difference.
Yeah.
We found that usually whenever you want to get these things right, all of the human elements had to be in place, whether it was social, economic, political, cultural. And getting all those things aligned often was difficult, not because the technology wasn't amenable to it, but because working with people who were not necessarily aligned was really difficult.
Do any examples come to mind?
Sure. I can think of one instance in which we tried to replace a system of network computers that a sugarcane cooperative was using in rural India just outside of Bombay. And, they had the system that was meant to communicate between the sugarcane cooperative and the processing plant with all the farmers. It turned out that the computer system was being eaten up by rats and, they were housed in these fertilizer sheds and so on. And so, it was costly to maintain. And we said, this, thanks to mobile phones these days, we can actually replace this entire system of PCs with simple mobile phones.
Right.
We did a pilot project in a few villages and showed that, in fact, farmers actually liked it even better because they could get the results more quickly and through their own phones. But we ran into a kind of a political rivalry within the cooperative where, the IT staff that had championed the project and the leaders of the cooperative were not completely in agreement. And so no matter how good the technology was, ultimately it didn't get rolled out to the other sites.
It strikes me right now that we're really in the midst of a new technology being sort of unveiled or rolled out before us. You know, it was only 7 or 8 years ago that the first smartphone was unleashed, and now, at least in a city like Washington, and I'm sure many places, you can't not find people just kind of staring and poking at their device. I have to think that technologies have social impacts, but in unpredictable ways.
Right. And I think you're pointing to something which is really interesting in that, you find that it turns out that every one of us as people have both productive and kind of a desire to be distracted tendencies. And the technology amplifies both. And so, of course, all of us are getting a lot of extra work done through our smartphones. But we're also acting like never before, like people who just seem to be completely oblivious of the surroundings.
Yeah, I would even question how much work we're getting done. I honestly, when I see people on the metro or, walking around, I don't perceive them as being productive. I see them as sort of filling out time or hunting for the next something.
It's definitely true that the technology may also be amplifying our kind of ability to deceive ourselves into thinking we're doing something productive.
You know, there's a scholar in, I believe, New York. Her name is Sherry Turkle, and she wrote a book called Alone Together. And in it, she talks about the ways that technology actually, even though we're more linked than ever, and, I can get updates from all of my friends instantaneously and that sort of thing. But in a weird way, technology, mobile phones, for example, also seem to be increasingly alienating us. I wonder if you saw unintended consequences of working with computers and technology in these situations in India.
Right. I'm familiar with the work and I'm a big fan of it. I think what she's discovered is that, again, human beings have a desire to have these very inexpensive, casual interactions as much as we do deep, intimate relationships. And, again, the technology amplifies both. Possibly for many people, it's amplifying our desire for kind of very superficial interactions so much that it's taking away time and space for our deeper relationships.
There's a section of your book it's in the early part, in the introduction, where you lay out, you begin by talking about Greek mythology, but I think at the end you kind of steer it back around to what is the unifying theme of your book, Geek Heresy. I wonder if you could just read those two graphs for us, please.
Absolutely. In Greek mythology, Daedalus was a brilliant craftsman and engineer. He designed a labyrinth that contained a Minotaur. He devised new methods of carpentry and shipbuilding. His animated statues were the world's first robots. But Daedalus is perhaps best known for the invention of flight. Imprisoned in a tower with his son Icarus, Daedalus fashioned wings out of feathers and wax. As they planned their escape, he warned Icarus not to fly too close to the sun for fear that the wax would melt. Once they were in the air, though, Icarus ignored his father's warnings. He soared exuberantly into the sky, his wings fell apart, and Icarus fell to his death. This story is often interpreted with a moral for children. Obey your parents, rein in hubris. But there's also a timeless lesson for the grown-ups. Brilliant technology is not enough to save us from ourselves. Tech proponents will insist that Daedalus needed wings to escape. Skeptics will say that Icarus would have been better off without them. But had Icarus exercised restraint, or had Daedalus taken more time with his son to convey the risks, they could have benefited from the technology without the tragedy. The real lesson, then, is not about technology at all. It's about the right kind of heart, mind, and will.
I think here you're clearly pointing out that perhaps critics of this book, you're not a Luddite. You're not advocating eschewing technology.
You're right. So again, you know, going back to amplification is potentially a very powerful force, and we'll need it to solve many of the big problems that are facing us. But it's like, you know, designing a better engine for a car. You can have the most powerful engine in the world, but if the driver isn't heading in the right direction, it won't get you where you want to go.
And my understanding is, in addition to your work at the School of Information at the University of Michigan, you also are a fellow at the Center of Ethics and Transformative Values at MIT. Help square the circle on how these seem to be two very different aspects, two very different discipline areas, and yet they seem to be unified in your book in that you are a technologist, but who wanted to achieve social ends.
I think there's a tendency between both technologists and technocrats either to believe that simply by making progress in technology or technocracy that the world will become a better place, or to suggest that, you know, their tools are tools and that they don't need to be involved in the larger decisions of how humanity will use those tools. And I fundamentally disagree with that. I think that as human beings, we have to be involved in the big decisions about resource allocation, about how our tools get used.
Mm-hmm.
And it's particularly important that those of us who understand the technology really get involved in these discussions, not in a way to just sell the technology, but also to make sure that the technology doesn't do harm.
Let me, if I may, put in a good word for the techno-utopians, I think you refer to them in your book. Isn't it a good thing, and isn't it an important thing to think big, even if the big things that you're thinking about or proposing may not lead to, you know, come to fruition?
I think it's great to think big, but I think we also have to think big responsibly. So we certainly shouldn't claim that our big ideas are of themselves going to solve, let's say, poverty or inequality when the evidence just suggests that doesn't happen. And we also need to be mindful that the resources that we suck up for our big ideas might mm-hmm. actually be better spent on other things for which we know they have good effects.
I can't let you go before cycling back to something that you'd mentioned at the beginning of this interview. You talked about not only your evolution as how you see technology and the effects that it can have, but also your evolution as a writer. Tell me about that a little bit.
Well, I was, again, trained as an academic, and so, you know, my writing tends to be pretty dry and dense. And I knew going in as I was writing this book that I needed to have more narrative, more stories, more anecdotes, but I didn't realize just how much. It's actually a very different thing to write in a way where you just write out the logic of your argument supported by facts and evidence, mm-hmm. as opposed to trying to convince people, trying to persuade people through stories,
right.
Which is a somewhat less direct way of getting at the deductive logic, but which in many ways is far more powerful in persuading people.
Something like the job that a journalist has.
Absolutely. I have an incredible amount of respect for journalists as a result of how difficult it was to write this book.
Kentaro Toyama, he's author of the book Geek Heresy, Rescuing Social Change from the Cult of Technology. Thank you so much for spending some time with us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Kentaro Toyama is an associate professor at the University of Michigan. His book Geek Heresy is out now, published by Public Affairs. Press Conference USA was produced by Anya Zalewski in our Washington and New York City studios. I'm Doug Bernard. Carol Castiel will be back next week with another edition of Press Conference USA here on The Voice of America.